You're tuned in to the Kojo Nam, the show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. A lot has been happening in local Washington, so we're taking this hour to hear from you. It's your turn to share your thoughts on the latest news in our region, whether you want to talk about alt-right demonstrations in Washington, kids being handcuffed for selling bottled water on the mall, Prince George's County public schools. You know the number? Let's start with this. D.C.'s Attorney General Carl Racine is suing a company, Sanford Capital, that many describe as a slumlord, over conditions at two of its properties. Tenants complain of broken locks, rodents, lack of heat, and shoddy maintenance. In a moment, we'll hear from a reporter who's been following the ongoing saga between Sanford Capital, its tenants, and the city. But first, have you ever lived in a derelict property? Do you think the city does enough to ensure that landlords follow housing codes? Start calling now. Sanford Capital owns more than 65 buildings across D.C., and most of its tenants are low-income people of color. Last week, Washington City Paper reported that the dozen residents left at Terrace Manor, that's a 61-unit property in southeast Washington near D.C.'s border with Maryland, are concerned about the company's plan to do away with the building. Joining me now by phone is Andrew Giambroni. He's a housing reporter for Washington City Paper. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo.
Andrew, can you explain that story for us?
Sure. The background is that, as you mentioned, the D.C. Attorney General, Carl Racine, is suing Sanford over two of its properties. One of those is Terrace Manor, pretty far-flung in southeast, just a little west of Sweetland Parkway. It's a total of 11 buildings. Sanford bought the property back in late 2012. When there were more than 50 tenants living there. Since then, that number has dwindled down to just about a dozen. So it's a little complicated, but there are actually two lawsuits or two cases ongoing at the same time related to Terrace Manor. One is in D.C. Superior Court, and that's where the Attorney General is suing over housing conditions and trying to get back some of the rents that the tenants paid when the property just became so derelict. And the other case that's ongoing is actually in federal bankruptcy court. In March, the LLC affiliate that controls Terrace Manor, which is in practical effect, a Sanford company, declared bankruptcy, trying to sell off the property for about $5.9 million. A complication there or a problem for the tenants is that under bankruptcy law in D.C., tenants don't have the right, like they normally do in other sales and purchases, to be able to try to buy the property on their own through a law that's known as TOPA, the Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act. And that's where we really are today, this ongoing lawsuit both in D.C. Superior Court and in this ongoing case where Sanford is trying to sell Terrace Manor and get around the tenant's TOPA rights in federal bankruptcy court.
In your reporting, you spent time at Sanford Capital's properties and with some of its residents. What did you discover? What kinds of conditions are tenants enduring? What impact are those conditions having on them?
It's really remarkable, just being a local reporter who gets to go out and visit people at their homes for his job. I will say with the Sanford Capital portfolio, like you said, it's more than 65 buildings across D.C. Basically, that means about 18 different properties or 18 different sites in southeast and northeast and a few in northwest. And it's the conditions across all of them are very standard for Sanford Capital. Like you said, bed bugs, rodents. Tenants often have been living there for more than 5 years, in some cases for generations. And, that's in particular what we've seen at Terrace Manor. People have been there for maybe 20 or 30 years in some cases as tenants, and who have seen it go into the ground, seen playgrounds been removed and benches and, basic amenities that they used to have. And the buildings really have become shells of what they used to be.
But aren't there laws in place to protect tenants from the housing conditions that you just described? How did things get so bad? What city agencies are responsible for protecting those tenants?
And that's where the frustration comes in for a lot of the tenants, who are happy that the Attorney General is going after Sanford Capital and even Mayor Bowser and her executive agencies, have been looking into the company a bit more this year after media reports, including ours and the Washington Post. But the real frustration is that it takes months and in some cases years for the city to essentially create a paper trail. There's the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs that's tasked with inspecting properties, both in response to complaints, as has been the case at some of these Sanford properties, and proactively, as they call it, just getting out every few years to see different properties. So the company's been cited, you know, to the tune of about $540,000 worth in potential fines. However, they're even challenging those at administrative court. So, you know, they haven't had to pay a penny for that those assessed fines, which is, you know, more than 1,000 citations just over the past year that they've got across their portfolio. So, the more we report on this, the more, and I don't mean to sound bleak about this, but we realize that it's the system, it's just the legal process and Sanford's right as a landlord to, you know, have their due process rights that, you know, tenants look at it and say nothing has changed, even with all this attention being paid to the company. So, you know, what is the city really doing for me? And that can be extremely frustrating.
Andrew Giambrone is a housing reporter for Washington City Paper, but this is your turn. We're expecting and hoping to hear your voice on all the issues we discussed today or anything else on your mind. You can call us at 800-433-8850 or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. In some of its headlines, Andrew, Washington City Paper refers to Sanford Capital as a slumlord, a characterization that the company's attorney vehemently denies. What defines a slumlord?
And that's a term we're not, you know, we don't use that lightly. You know, our reporting is based on dozens of interviews with tenants and their legal advocates. So when we drop the S word, as some in the real estate business call it, you know, we're backing it up with months of reporting. You know, for us, when we use it, what we see is just lack of security at these properties, you know, not having locked doors, vagrants and squatters being able to come in and occupy vacant units or occupy common areas like basements, electricity that doesn't work and goes out, unreliable appliances, and heat. And another thing, and I don't want to neglect this aspect of it, but just the psychology of being a tenant at a slumlord property. You feel abandoned, you feel sort of forsaken by the landlord, and there's just a complete or extreme amount of lack of communication between you as a tenant and the maintenance company. Sanford has their own, in this case, in-house maintenance company called Oakmont that's been around for a few years, and just, you know, we've heard so many stories about tenants across their property saying that they called the number, it's an 800 number. They get a work order, but nothing ever comes of it. And it's just, you know, they roll, the tenants have to live with that.
Well, let me ask our listeners, how would you define slumlord? Have you ever had to deal with one in the district? Give us a call now, 800-433-8850. Here's Michelle in Bowie, Maryland. Michelle, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Kojo, thank you for having such a wonderful show day in and day out. I live in Bowie. My family and I have a home that we own at this time, but from my childhood over many years, we have been in a rental position, and I think it's a very important subject that you're bringing up. Often there is a feeling of powerlessness and then actually being ignored as a renter. I'll take answers or comments off the air, but thank you so much for bringing this very forward. It's important,
Michelle,
that the renter has a voice.
Michelle, I'm glad you brought that issue because I think Steve in Alexandria, Virginia also wants to raise the same issue. Steve, your turn.
Kojo, it's a pleasure to be on. Michelle stated it perfectly. This is kind of something that pops up in everybody's mind and wish people talked about a little bit more. We talk on a more macro level with regards to government getting involved, but as a person, go to work 9 to 5, come back to your residence, and then take care of other things, who do we have to contact? What resources do we have to pull from, and could you provide that list of resources?
Andrew Giambrone, in the district, that usually is the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, is it?
Yes. For any sort of housing complaints that you might have, you know, whether it relates to lack of heat, you know, rodents, and anything that could be a violation of D.C.'s housing code, DCRA is the agency that supposed to document that and enforce the housing code.
Any knowledge about Virginia?
I'm not sure what their building department is called, but I'm sure, especially in jurisdictions like Arlington and Alexandria, there are kind of sister agencies to DCRA that have the same protocol or similar protocols.
And of course, we've been talking about how the Attorney General Carl Racine has filed suit against Sanford Realty, but we got a tweet from Greg in reference to the city's oversight of landlords. Greg writes, have ever noticed how DC Council has poor oversight on programs that it funds and manages? Is there a role for the council in all of this in terms of overseeing enforcement, Andrew?
Yes. You know, there's several committees that touch housing in some way. We're talking about a legislature of 13 different members, including a chairman. There's a housing committee. There's a government operations committee. So on paper, you know, it sounds a little wonky, but the council is elected to oversee and make sure that the executive is enforcing the law. I believe in this past budget, the council was able to get funding for a few more DCRA inspectors. You know, they've talked a lot about Sanford as a sort of a bad example of a major landlord in D.C., particularly of affordable housing. And that's a point I don't want to be lost on our listeners, that we're talking about low-income affordable housing for people of color mostly. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there is a legal process at play. And, you know, that can take months or years to play out. The council's powers are limited in that respect.
Kishan Putta sent us a tweet, says, as an ANC, saddest day was when two young constituents died in an unsafe, unlicensed apartment that burned them alive. The landlord did not license the apartment and did not have required safety features. On now to Tim in Vienna, Virginia. Tim, your turn.
Oh, hey, Kojo. Thanks for having me. I just want to say that it seems to me the purpose of going after these landlords or slumlords, whatever you want to call them, is really to drive the people out. I don't think they want low-income housing in D.C. I think they're trying to drive them into PG County, because what they really want is to turn these into mixed-use, like, apartments for, you know, young, more affluent white people to move into. And it just seems to me like the point is to go after the landlords to drive out the tenants. That's kind of the way I look at it.
Well, I suspect, Andrew Giambroni, that what the city will say is that it's going after the landlord so that they can provide a more safe, secure, and livable harbor for the tenants, and that they may probably blame the landlords for trying to drive low-income residents of color out.
Yeah, and that's a response we've heard from all parts of D.C.'s local government, Carl Racine and the Attorney General, Mayor Bowser, the executive branch, and various members on the D.C. Council. Of course, there's a political considerations there. We've got the elections coming up in just about a year from now for the June primary, and, you know, who gets to claim credit for protecting low-income tenants the most? I think that's at least one question voters, especially east of the Anacostia River, may be asking themselves when they want to go vote. So really, yeah, there's a lot of political considerations that go into making a landlord like Sanford a political cause.
Andrew Giambroni, he is the housing correspondent for Washington City Paper. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo, as always.
It is your turn. If you've called about this issue, stay on the line. We will get to your calls. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll look at some more issues, what's happening in Prince George's County schools, the President Muslim ban, which in part has been allowed by the Supreme Court, kids selling water, being handcuffed on the mall, and alt-right demonstrations in the city. If you want to call about any of those things, you can start now. It's your turn. I'm Kojo Nandi.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. It's your turn in terms of the subject we were just discussing, what's happening with some tenants in low-income housing. We got a tweet from Councilmember Charles Allen's office. He represents Ward 6 on the council. He said also today, council will vote to pass a law providing housing attorneys to low-income tenants in housing court. Again, I said that from D.C. Councilmember Charles Allen. It is your turn. According to the Washington Post, the latest data show that nearly 850 employees have been placed on leave from Prince George's County school system this year. Several educators shared their stories with the Post, including a counselor who says he was accused of failing to report a physical exchange that he didn't even see. And a teacher who says she was suspended for kissing a girl on the top of the head after the girl hugged her. Is Prince George's County going too far, or is it doing what it's necessary to protect students? What level of contact between school staff and children is appropriate, and how harshly should the system crack down on its employees? As of June 6th, nearly 150 teachers were off the job. Are you affiliated with the Prince George's County school system in any way, parent, employee? How does the number of teachers on leave impact students? The number of staff on leave has increased more than 1,000% in the past 2 years after child abuse scandals plagued the system. School officials say they've paid almost $10 million to employees on administrative leave this school year, compared to $630,000 just 2 years ago. What impact do you think that jump in spending has? Is that a good use of money by the county? If not, how do you think it should be better spent? This is your turn, so call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Here is Ani in Southeast D.C. Ani, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you for holding the show. And I am a homeowner, a general public, lived in Anacostia for 2 years. And every day I pass my home, I pass by the neighborhood going home, and I witness a lot of a lot of areas in this Anacostia has been neglected. And I really feel this area is a lack of investment, such as we don't even have a grocery store for the neighbors to go with. And it's obviously this lack of city development, the lack of plans of recreation, such as park and playgrounds for kids. And I just think this place is really such a waste, and it's a beautiful place to live with.
What would you like to see happen there, Ani?
Yeah, obviously, playground, park, people can jog and feel comfortable for families to hang around and enjoy the environment.
Well, there's development that's coming to that part of the city. The controversy, of course, is whether or not the low-income residents in that part of the city will be afforded to live in the development there. It is obviously your hope that they will.
Yeah, and I look forward for that day. And another opinion I would like to give, and I'm living in a gated community, and it's really beautiful. And my neighbor is landlord, and they rent out a place. But I noticed the house that they rent out, and they are not doing anything to upgrade for tenants to live in the place. And such as the storm doors is always not locked. And then, you know, when the wind blows, it's, you know, banging at the door. So, and and since your topic is talking about landlords, how to control the quality for the tenants to live in this neighborhood. And I think, you know, the landlords really need to pay attention to provide quality living place.
Well,
and
you should know, Ani, that some landlords also make complaints about how the tenants conduct themselves. So here is Karen in Manassas, Virginia. Karen, your turn.
Hello, Kojo. Glad to speak with you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My father, he was a carpenter, construction worker for many years, and he built a lot of these low-income apartment buildings throughout the 80s. And one project in particular, they did it in phases. And he was contracted by the owners to go ahead and do the maintenance for the buildings as well. And as they were completing the second and third phases of this development, people were already moving into the completed first phase. As they were living in there, he was already being called over to fix lighting fixtures that, you know, incidentally fell off the wall, cabinets that fell off the wall, door locks that happened to mysteriously break. And, you know, a lot of these slumlords are being accused of being slumlords when they can't control the behaviors of the tenants living in the building. My question is there anything being done to address the construction of the properties before the tenants move in, or even as we're transitioning and updating these buildings, to make them more indestructible?
I don't know if what can be done to make them more indestructible, if what you're talking about are the behavior of tenants who misuse the housing facilities in which they live, then there are laws that can cause those tenants to be evicted if that is an ongoing occurrence. And I know that landlords very often do apply those laws, even though at the same time they complain that it is quite difficult to get the most disruptive or the most law-breaking tenants out of their housing. Obviously, the city doesn't want to put people out on every complaint that is filed against them. But in terms of whether or not these places can be made more indestructible or less destructible, I am no expert on that. But thank you very much for your call. Moving on now to Karen in Washington. Karen, your turn.
Hi, Kojo. Love your show. My name is Karen Siobhan Robinson. I am a former ANC commissioner over here at DuPont Circle, and I also did public affairs for DCRA many years ago.
Yes.
And I just want to say, you know, in terms of affordable housing in D.C., what happens with the tenants' rights laws is the council writes tenants' rights laws. The appropriate agencies enforce them. But there are lawyers and associations in D.C. whose sole purpose is to get around those laws. And when they do that, by the time that is fixed, the tenants have already been harmed. I don't know the solution, but I will tell you, there's a lawyer named Richard Lux. He is behind, like, the 95-5. I'm using shortcuts, but I hope you remember that in the about a decade ago, which got around tenants' rights laws. The law is, if you sell a building, the tenants have to have the opportunity to purchase.
Except that as Andrew Giambroni was explaining, if the landlord goes into bankruptcy here in the district, then the tenants apparently no longer have that right.
Exactly. But there was also a thing called 95-5 where the landlord would sell 95% of a property and retain 5% and say that the building hadn't been sold. Okay. So there are all these little loopholes that these people are getting around, and tenants are being harmed. The last thing I'll say is I live at DuPont Circle. I live in one of the last affordable buildings here at DuPont Circle, and our landlord wants us gone. And they've made offers to people to buy them out. And when I first moved to DuPont Circle more than a decade ago, there was actually affordable housing here. All that's gone.
Now you're it.
Now we're, well, not anymore, because they want to turn this apartment building into luxury apartments. So those of us who stay won't get the upgrades, but they're upgrading all the apartments around us. So I don't know.
And is that something you're trying to fight, and what legal options are available for you to fight that?
Okay, so Kojo, yes, we tried to fight. We're known as a litigious building. We fought off three attempts to buy us during the condo phase. Landlord basically came to us and said, hey, look, we want to change the building, and you've got some choices here. You can voluntarily go along with this, and we'll give you a little bit of money, or you can fight this. We will probably win, and you won't get any money. I will say this. It was, you know, I felt very kind of godfathery around it, because it's kind of like, you know, you don't, they give you choices, but you really don't have any choices.
Yeah.
And in order to retain our rights, since they had all the power, they did it. The other thing they did was there are a number of people who've been here a very long time.
Okay, got to move on, so make this quick.
Sure, I will. You know what? I won't. But I will just say this, Kojo.
Mm-hmm.
And final, the tenants' rights laws are there, but they're loopholes. And somehow the council has got to figure out how to fix it.
Thank you very much for your call,
Kojo,
and for telling us that story. It is your turn. We got an email from Pamela about ATVs and dirt bikes. What is the police plan to address this? Does someone have to get hurt? I saw a group on the Beltway stop traffic and endanger drivers. The police were present and just let them go. That has been, in the past 2 or 3 days, been reported fairly extensively in local news media about the problems posted by ATVs and dirt bikes, the safety problems posted to pedestrians, the safety problems to themselves and to motorists. And we have yet to, we know that the police have said that they are dealing with this and they're trying to identify these people and doing something about it. But speaking of police, on Thursday, pictures quickly spread on Twitter of U.S. Park police handcuffing black teenagers who were doing something that happens every day on the National Mall. They were selling bottled water. D.C. Councilmember Charles Allen condemned the move, writing in a letter to the Park Police Chief that if there had been young girls selling lemonade, and quoting here, "I doubt we would have seen little girls in pigtails handcuffed on the ground." Do you agree? Do you think the incident is a reflection of how young black men are treated by police? You can call now, 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. We got a tweet from Carol who says, "The water incident is an example of how black men, women, children, trans folks, and the disabled are treated with disregard, fear, and lack of respect, and as second-class citizens." Well, joining us now is the person who witnessed the incident and posted the photos to Twitter, Tim Krepp. He is a tour guide and writer here in Washington. Tim Krepp, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Kojo.
Tim, tell us what happened on Thursday, and how did you come upon the young black men being handcuffed?
Right, Kojo. It was pretty self-evident. I was finishing up a tour on the mall. I was walking to the metro, and it was exactly like it looked in the picture. I come across the scene of several young black men being arrested. Well, I guess being handcuffed. I can't say for certain they're arrested, of course. But they're being handcuffed. They were on the ground, and several white police officers were standing over them. One was kneeling down and lecturing one of them, something along the lines of, "You guys here all the time. I don't know why you're here all the time." I didn't quite get the full gist of that. I did not want to interfere with the officers. I didn't want to get in the middle of something that was going down. But I did go ask one of the young men, "What happened? What was going on here?" And he goes, "Well, we're just selling water." So I took the pictures. I posted them on Twitter, and then it all blew up very, very quickly afterwards.
You work as a tour guide, so you spend a lot of time on the National Mall. Is it common for the Park Police to handcuff people for selling water bottles? The explanation was given is that this was a plainclothes force that was targeting illegal vending on the mall. Have you seen this before?
There was two things that struck me as different in this incident. I have seen Park Police out there, of course. As you mentioned, we see the water vendors, dollar water guys out all the time. I've bought my share of water from them in the past. But two things struck me as different here that I've never seen before. One, the plainclothes nature of the officers. They were not in uniform. They were wearing plain clothes. One guy was wearing a Leonard Skinner shirt and a Harley Davidson shirt on top of that.
Made it seem like some kind of undercover operation.
Right. And so that was very different. And the other thing, as you noticed, I've never seen anyone be handcuffed for this type of citation. I've seen, of course, the police officers, uniform officers, shooing folks away, or I've seen, even at times, a citation being written. Certainly we see that a lot with the food trucks that are down on the mall. But I've never seen anyone be handcuffed for that. And that's where I drew the line. That's where that was the big change for me of the handling of what are fellow citizens, who are fellow citizens. That was the big bright line for me distinction.
Let me ask our listeners, do you think the race of the people selling the water bottles was a factor in the Park Police's decision to handcuff them? Give us a call at 800-433-8850. How should, in your view, police handle people selling beverages on the mall who aren't supposed to be doing that? You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show, email to kojo@wamu.org, or call the number now, 800-433-8850. Tim Krebs, the photos you posted on Twitter of the incident quickly went viral and were reposted thousands of times. What kinds of responses have you been getting online?
It's been varied. There's been obviously a lot of anger at the police officers, and a lot of anger going on that level, a lot of resignation and dismay. Of course, there have been this fair number of racist trolls and whatever, but that's to be expected. And although we have a little fun bantering and mocking them, I largely don't take that too seriously. But what I've been impressed with, is the amount of people that have said, hey, we want to use this as something to do better. We want to see an improvement on these things. And so there's been that's been very encouraging for me.
There were people who didn't raise the issue of race, who said, look, they were breaking the law. That's what happens to people who break the law.
There was a kind of disappointing for me, a lot of rather authoritarian-minded people, which I find ahistorical. I mean, we are literally on the National Mall. Within sight of this is, and I don't want to use the cliche within blocks of, but we're looking at the Washington Monument. I mean, George Washington is a guy that defied legal and lawful British authority for something he thought was right. Now, I'm not raising selling water as a moral cause here, but we are a nation that is based on saying enough to authority, saying that we are not just followers of authority, that we make our own decisions as citizens of this republic. That's what we're founded upon. That's the narrative that I'm selling to school kids, and I turn around and see this, well, just follow the rules kind of bit. I'm like, I got 99 problems on the National Mall. Water selling is not one of them.
But you obviously took photos. Did the police see you taking the photos? Were there any objections to that?
I'm certain they did. In fact, I think one officer turned his head, which obviously he's more than welcome to do so, and try to hide himself. There was no other response there. They didn't say anything to me. They didn't address me at all. There was no interaction between me and the police officers at all.
We got a few calls on this. Here is Eric in Alexandria, Virginia. Eric, your turn.
Hello, how are you?
Go right ahead, Eric. You're on the air. It's your turn.
Yes, I think this is a more systemic issue having to deal with African-Americans in general being underserved throughout the entire history that since they've been, came here as slaves. Back as early as the 1700s. And I think that when I talk about reparations to try and give African Americans a hand up, not a hand out, it's not monetary reparations. What I'm talking about is just putting more dollars into schools, into after school activities, so that these young kids have something to do. And this correlates directly with these young African American males simply trying to sell water to make a dollar. You know, what else? And I know that there's other ethnicities.
Well, you're breaking up on us, but I think we have your fundamental point that they were simply trying to be entrepreneurs, and that was obviously not encouraged at all. On to Sheila in Fairfax, Virginia. Sheila, your turn.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I'm a white senior, and I think it's absolutely ridiculous that they would handcuff any type of young men for the same thing. I agree with that, being entrepreneurs. And it's like, you want these children to, these young people to do things, and then you penalize them. Now, if the people explain to them maybe they need a license or whatever, and then tell them how to get it, I mean, thank God these young people are going out and doing things, especially when there's no jobs, no summer jobs for them. But to handcuff, so there's two issues. It's like, they should be applauded for doing something, and two, that anybody should be handcuffed. Is this still America? I sometimes wonder. So anyway, my views are a little bit extreme, but anyway, that's it.
Thank you very much for your call, Sheila. Before we go to a break, here's Gail in Washington. Gail, your turn.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you very much. I also agree that I admire these young people when I see them on street corners and in the parks being very entrepreneurial and selling water and doing things to earn money when they don't necessarily have other means for them to be able to do so. I think that if we need to, we should create a little pop-up license for people to be able to do this. I think that handcuffing them was outrageous, and I'm so sad to see that happen in our capital.
Thank you very much for your call, Gail. We got a lot of comments on Twitter. One from Giovanna Jones says they handcuff those kids to humiliate them, to break them down as young black men. Another, Lee Emerson Smith, says lifeguards and cops at Miami Beach tell vendors to move along. These undercover guys must have known something we don't know about the vendors. Well, apparently they didn't, because they let them go, and a park police official was apparently quoted as saying that this whole incident is being overblown. And we got this tweet from Rika, who says maybe the park police should provide free filtered water to visitors at the National Mall. And Jessica Raven says, this is absolutely about race. I see kids selling lemonade all the time. They're no threat to public safety. I think we have at least one more. This is supposed to be a capitalist society, says Linda Sanderson. Why have we criminalized certain types of capitalism? It's your turn, and you're certainly taking advantage of it, but we've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about alt-right rallies taking place in Washington, the health care bill, and the president's Muslim ban. So if you want to call about those issues right now, your turn. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back to Your Turn, where we've been talking about the park police handcuffing three youths who were selling bottled water there, and the overwhelming majority of people seemed to feel that this was overreach on the part of the park police. We did invite the National Park Service park police to the broadcast, but they declined. However, that does not mean that there are not people who are in support of them. Here is Dave in Columbia, Maryland. Dave, you're on the air. Your turn.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call. Now, I'm not going to say that these youths needed to be handcuffed or not. I wasn't there. I don't know the situation. And maybe that was a bit excessive. But I am in support of getting these illegal vendors off of the streets. I mean, the people who are vending there legally pay a lot of money to do so. They're there trying to make an honest living, and then to have people come in and undercut, you know, their businesses really hurts. I know people who have small businesses where illegal vending does hurt them. I visit the city of Baltimore, and every single corner has an illegal vendor on it. And quite frankly, the city's a mess because of it. There's empty bottles everywhere. Every time you stop, there's people trying to sell you something. And, you know, like I said, I'm not saying I never think there should be.
Well, the complaints very often do come from licensed vendors, and it's presumably to those complaints that the park police have been responding. And obviously, if you are not licensed to sell anything on the mall, they have an obligation to tell you that, and presumably an obligation to tell you to move on. The question, exactly, of course, is whether you have an obligation to handcuff teenagers, even though they were ultimately released. But you do make a good point, and thank you for doing so.
I will say we weren't there, so we don't know. I mean, we weren't in the officer's shoes, and I don't think it's fair to speculate, hey, if these were, you know, Girl Scouts selling cookies, they wouldn't have done it. You can't speculate on each situation. I mean, these officers face a lot of safety concerns, and I'm not saying that this was justified. I don't know the facts, and I think until we know the facts, we can't make presumptions.
Well, from what we know of the facts so far, it would appear that these young men were not in any way threatening to the officers. But we do have to move on. Thank you so much for your call. Over the weekend, conservative activists gathered on the National Mall for a pair of rallies. One of the demonstrations was led by Richard Spencer, the white nationalist founder of the so-called alt-right movement. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
The most radical thing for anyone to say is, I am white. My life has meaning. My life has dignity. I am part of a family. I will fight for my children's future. That is what they want to suppress.
That's Richard Spencer addressing that rally this weekend. There were several other rallies on the Mall this weekend, some of them specifically to counter his group, another which was apparently staged by an offshoot of his group. But how do you feel about his statement and the fact that D.C. has become a meeting place for alt-right protesters? 800-433-8850 is the number to call. The First Amendment guarantees all citizens the right to free speech. What do you feel is the best way to respond to a speech like that? 800-433-8850. You can send us email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. We received a comment on our website that I'm apparently just lost, but who wanted to respond to the demonstration there and how we would characterize that demonstration. Until I can find that, allow me to go back to some of the topics we have been discussing earlier. We got an email from Doga who says, how is it possible that Sanford owes D.C. thousands in fines yet continues to pay Sanford rent subsidies? Why can't D.C. just deduct what Sanford owes from those payments? A question that I, for one, cannot answer for sure. 800-433-8850. The GOP-led effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act was dealt a tough blow yesterday. The Congressional Budget Office released new numbers revealing that the Senate health care bill would increase the number of people without health insurance by 22 million by 2026. The White House quickly discounted the report, saying the Budget Office is often inaccurate in its predictions. Any changes to the federal health care law are sure to have an impact locally, where many people rely on Medicaid and the healthcare exchanges for their insurance. What changes would you like to see, if any, to federal healthcare laws? Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Here is Kurt in Washington, D.C. Kurt, it's your turn. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, how you doing today, Mr. Kojo? Thanks for having me on your show. I wanted to say that, first of all, other countries have free healthcare, and they're not as great as this nation is. So why should the rich be benefiting off of the backs of the poor? I mean, it's just totally unfair and so wrong for the rich to get a tax break and they're taking the money from the poor. I mean, that's not right at all. And then for President Trump to say something about he doesn't want poor people, you know, working in as public officials. I mean, how can there be any balance in society? You know, I just think it's so wrong that the poor have to suffer for the rich. I mean, the rich already, they're wealthy, they have plenty of money.
Were you a supporter of the Affordable Care Act?
Yes, sir, I was, because it helped people out with prescription medications. You know, it helped the handicapped out, the mental ill. You know what I mean? This country already has a crisis with the mentally ill, especially since St. Elizabeth closed down. There are thousands, if not tens of thousands,
but you also
walking around the streets.
You also seem to be opposed in particular to the fact that this bill, which is on its face about health care, includes tax cuts.
Yeah, for the simple fact that this, I mean, the rich already, they're wealthy enough. Why should they be given a tax cut, you know, at the expense of the poor people? I mean, it's just not right. You know, the reason people are poor in this country basically is because the people that are rich, the wealth is not equally shared. And that's a part of the problem today that we see.
Well, what would you say to the argument for people who favor the tax cuts, who say the people who get these tax cuts, the wealthy, are the people who create jobs in this country, and that it will help the economy if they get a tax cut?
Well, what I would say is basically that the people that are poor have a right to these taxes. You know, you can't just take all the taxes from the country. I mean, they send, you know, all these spaceships to the moon, and they got the spa, these Mars programs. You know, they got the defense budget. It's too much of the taxpayers' money already going to all these other parts of government. I mean, Okay. Come on, let's be fair with the money and give the poor something, too.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. We got an email from Joe in Leesburg who says, on the subject of the alt-right, why dignify the movement with their self-assigned moniker? We should be calling this Christian white nationalism and not allowing them to hide behind new names. It's the same racist agenda of before. The clever name doesn't hide it. Well, I suspect that's one of the reasons, Joe, that they came up with what you characterize as the clever name, so that it would not be associated with white nationalism. It would not be associated with the Ku Klux Klan. It would not be associated with the white socialist parties that existed in the past. But it is clear that people like you see different name, same agenda. On now to Wanda in Washington. Wanda, it is your turn. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I just want to make a quick statement. When I was probably like about, 12, 13, my brothers and sisters and I and the neighbor kids, we stripped our cherry tree in our backyard, the grapevine on the fence, and the pear tree in the neighbor's backyard. She was too old to climb the tree, so she didn't care. And we sold things out in front of our houses to cars that were going by. When my dad got home, he was mad at me, and I got in trouble for not asking Mrs. Brown if we could strip the pear tree. And she said it would have been fine, but that's not what the point is. The point is these kids were being entrepreneurial. Hey, we're going to start with the water on the mall. We're going to make some money, and then we're going to reinvest and do this, that, and the other thing. I figured that's probably what they had in mind, and the park police were probably white, and they were letting them know in no uncertain terms, this is your place. You better stay in it.
And that's your view, Wanda. Thank you for sharing it. Matthew may have a slightly different view. Matthew, your turn.
Yes, I'm calling from Northern Virginia, and, you know, right on the Park Service's website, it's very easy to look up. It only takes a second. There's actually only six things that you're allowed to sell on Park Service property. It's books, newspapers, leaflets, pamphlets, buttons, and bumper stickers. And it's everything else is not allowed. You can't sell a flag. You can't sell a cherry. You can't sell your shoes. And nothing else is permitted. And it's our National Park Service. So it's to protect and preserve the sanctity of the thing. Now, if you let everyone show up and sell water, then it'll just turn into a flea market.
I don't think people were arguing that everyone should be allowed to show up and sell water. I don't think people were even arguing that the sale of water is illegal. There were some people arguing that there needs to be more facilities where people can purchase water on the mall when it gets hot. But I think the main objection was to how the young people, the teenagers selling water, were treated. They were handcuffed. That seems to be the main objection.
I got handcuffed as a teenager selling stuff on that property. Now I'm 45 years old. So this was in the 80s. I was selling a normal T-shirt on the mall law, National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Law. And I got handcuffed and arrested by white police officers. I got thrown to the ground, and I'm a white guy. So I don't think it was racially motivated, because the same thing happened to me in the 80s when I was selling T-shirts.
And in the end, in a way, normal one, because marijuana is now legal in the District of Columbia, even though you cannot use it on the National Mall. But I'm afraid that's all the time we have right now. Matthew, thank you very much for your call. Except time to try to read one more email, and that is from a listener who said, I overheard your comment on Prince George's County Public Schools in regards to the 850 individuals who are put on leave. You mentioned if this was going too far or whether these were appropriate steps being taken to keep children safe. I worked in a Prince George's County Public School charter school for 4 years, and my experience tells me they aren't doing this truly for either, but to simply avoid lawsuits. In reality, this is something that really affects all school systems, but PGCBS is more likely to be sued for a variety of reasons. And that is the opinion of a listener who says she or he worked in Prince George's County Public Schools, and I'm afraid that's all the time we have right now. That's it for the show today. Thank you all for participating in this edition of Your Turn. There's going to be a lot happening around town this week. If you're going to be roaming around the Smithsonian's Folklife Festival, I'll be there too. I'd like to see you. I'll be hosting a panel about ethics and media representation Thursday, 3:30 p.m. at the Story Circle stage next to the National Museum of Natural History. You can find all the information about this at wamu.org/events. You should also know that WAMU producer Michaela LaFrac will be in conversation tonight with author Beth Koblener at 6th and I about the book Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. That event begins at 7 p.m. And don't forget to meet us back here tomorrow. We'll be talking about how D.C. became the first place in the country to offer a non-binary gender option on driver's licenses. We'll also explore what the opening and closing of restaurants tells us about the life cycles of local neighborhoods. That's all at noon tomorrow. Until then, thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Avery Kleiman, and Patrick Fort. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Cliff Gallagher has been on the phone. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.